Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're talking today about the nature of urban life in the late 19th century. And that's consequential because, in a sense, it's getting towards, as it were, the recovered memory, which is offered to people in television programs on, you know, people looking for their ancestors or people looking at houses and so on. So I think, again, we need to slow down a little bit further in order to try and capture the accuracy of what is going on. So I'll start off by saying that what you can point to is, as you would not be surprised, as is the condition for any period of historical time, both good and bad. And we can notice improvement, but we can also notice very difficult circumstances. There was the graciousness of a new urban townscapes of major railway stations, the sort of St. Pancras's of this world, and great public buildings. And there are also slums or things like the great stink of the Thames in London in 1858, when river pollution made the City of London and right the way seem a health hazard. And indeed, I was looking up some of the figures for Newcastle, where I lived for some years, in 1854. We've got to get the punctuation right. I wasn't living there in 1854. In 1854, about 7,840 of the 22,000 or 20,000 families in the city lived in only one room. And we're not talking about vast rooms. In 1852, 8,032 of the 9,453 houses in Newcastle lacked toilets. In 1866, still 43% of the city's population was living in dwellings of only one or two rooms. And in 1885, 30.6%. So the population living in terrible circumstances is declining, plus, plus. But there are still many people living in those circumstances, minus, minus. Newcastle's mortality rates fell from 30.1 per thousand in 1872 to 19.1 per thousand. That's an annual mortality rate in 1901. But at the same time, the mortality contrast between the registration districts in Newcastle remained the case, and with obviously some areas doing particularly badly. So in 1881, for Newcastle registration districts, the contrasts were between 17.1 per thousand and 41.5 per thousand. Again, you might say the same is true today. It is true today, but it also needs bringing out that it was true in the past, and that's one way of looking at the past and also a way of looking at the present. Urban poverty was described by novelists, including George Gissing in Workers in the Dawn, which came out in 1880, and Andrew Mearns in The Bitter Cry of Outcast London, which came out in 1883. Mortality rates as a whole varied not only within towns, but also between towns, as well as between town and country. In part, there are managerial issues in public policy. There's social stigmatism at the expense of the poor, who didn't generally get the much investment. So, for example, in Bradford, there were gastrointestinal disorders linked to inadequate water and sewerage systems, which were responsible for the city's very high infant mortality rate. Or the burial records of the Bonner Hill Cemetery in Kingston, Surrey, indicate that from 1855 to 1911, one third of all burials there were of children aged four or under. For August and September 1899, when 44 infants under one died of diarrhoea in Kingston, Surrey, the medical officer of health reported, quote, Only one infant was brought up entirely at the breast and six partly at the breast and partly by artificial feeding. In only eight houses was there a decent larder where milk could be stored, and this is a defect found in houses of even a high rental where the larder is often placed so as to be practically useless. It may be placed so as to be exposed to the hot sun for the greatest possible number of hours, or it may be just over the sink waste or in close communication with a WC, or where ventilation is only obtained with the accompaniment of dust. So what he's writing about is that the infants that are dying are infants that are dependent not on breast milk, but on prepared milk. And these infants are suffering from the lack of facilities where milk can be safely stored. It ought to be borne in mind, because at the present moment we have all the climate protesters and people protesting about how much electricity is used, and et cetera, that this situation really didn't improve till you were able to have effective refrigeration in individual residences, as well as obviously in shops, and that required fridges. And fridges used a lot of electricity. And it's another example of what people don't like talking about, which is the extent to which technological development, industrial progress, rising prosperity obviously had an impact on the environment, but also produced many good facilities. That is, if you think it's a good thing that children under the age of one shouldn't die of diarrhea, but obviously climate activists might take a different perspective on this. Across the country, diphtheria and measles were particularly serious, and they were exacerbated by damp houses. Again, heating houses, not just insulating, but heating houses was very important to health, both in terms of warmth and in terms of banishing damp. Reports on Bruton in Somerset in the 1870s and 1880s graphically described insufficient and defective toilet arrangements, inadequate sewerage disposal, and a lack of clean water. A reluctance to spend water ensured that plans to improve the situation were delayed, and though the sewerage system was finally improved, Bruton did not construct a water supply system in the Victorian period. Similarly, for financial reasons, there was opposition in Ealing to the improvement of sanitation and water supplies. More generally, urban living as well as urban growth posed major problems, and their scale was unprecedented. Now, the rapidly growing populations of the industrial cities, and indeed of towns as a whole, had to be housed. And one of the ways in which the changing country of the late 19th and early 20th century is still with us is that much of the housing stock today derives from that period. When I lived in Durham from 1980 to 83 and in Newcastle from 83 to 96, those three houses all derived from the late 19th century. Whereas a relatively small percentage of the current stock survives from earlier periods and noticeably so in urban areas. By the 1860s, the terrace streets we know today were being built. And by the 1870s, a standard version of working-class housing was the two-up, two-down, through terrace, with its access at both front and rear, solid construction, adequately ventilated, sometimes with small gardens or a backyard. Increasingly, this was becoming the standard dwelling. And as I said, I lived in such a house in Durham in 1981-3. It indeed had a ground floor bathroom as a later addition because water pressure issues affected the location of the bath. The traditional terraced house was a consequence of the rise in average real wages in the 1850s and 60s as the economic boom of industrialization brought prosperity. These houses were a great improvement on the back-to-backs, the lodging house and the damp cellar, in which all too many had lived. In part, this was because terraced houses were built at a time of prosperity and rising construction standards in new residences, including covered sewerage systems and adequately piped clean water. Indeed, from 1875, under the Public Health Act, which also restricted what were called cellar dwellings, it was mandatory to provide not only damp-proof courses in new houses, but also lavatories on the same plot as a new house. Now, this generally meant outside lavatories, and many houses weren't converted to have inside ones until the late 20th century, but nevertheless, they were there. These houses, with their separate rooms, enabled greater definition of the spheres of domestic activity, from chatting or reading to eating or sleeping, all of which had major implications for family behaviour and gender roles, as well as for a sense of privacy. Now, the pattern replaced an earlier style of layout, frequently described in terms of a warren, and often you can see that in place names in old towns, such and such court, which was often a sort of courtyard around which there were houses of a poor character and value. This had been a style that was difficult to keep clean or to light because it contained too many self-enclosed alleyways, closes, or courts. In contrast, the straight streets of terraced houses, equally apportioned and relatively spaciously laid out by earlier standards, were easier to light, and they were easier to provide with supplies of gas or water or drainage, a situation that was true not only of areas as a whole, but also of individual properties. Legislation, it was not just prosperity that was significant, but also legislation. So the removal of the brick tax in 1850 encouraged the large-scale utilisation of bricks in construction, and their use helped to keep damp at bay as opposed to sort of earth or wattle and daub kind of dwellings, or timber for that matter. While the end of the wallpaper tax in 1861 affected the interior of houses. Technology also played a role. So inexpensive linoleum, what lino, from the mid-1870s was an effective floor covering. When I was growing up in the late 50s and 60s, there was lino on the floor, for example, in the kitchen, easy to clean. Terraced houses were usually built in straight streets. The move towards straighter streets owed much to the growing volume of horse-drawn and wheeled traffic, which benefited from such streets, as changing direction was not easy for this traffic. There was also better road surfacing. That was significant, although I think it's fair to say that increasing the speed of traffic in towns entailed banishing pedestrians from the street to an often non-existent pavement. Indeed, there was a development that was even more, the development of a segregation even more apparent today given the lethality of cars. Rather than seeing the working class as beneficiaries of simply municipal agency, the entrepreneurialism of developers, the technology of inventors, it's also worth saying that they had agency as well. They could take the initiative in order to improve their living arrangements, to take advantage of their new homes and decoration, and could adapt their social structure to the possibilities of the housing stock. Nevertheless, it's worth saying that many of the urban poor and casually employed, you know, the less well-off, still lived in one-room dwellings, tenements, back-to-backs, rookeries and courts, and would continue to do so until World War II, when incidentally a fair amount were heavily damaged in bombing in London, particularly in the East End area. Their walls frequently ran with damp, sanitation was often primitive, lighting was limited, poorly swept chimneys contributed to the fog in many homes, with health greatly affected as a consequence. Indeed, the Ministry of Health report on pollution from domestic coal fires in 1920 drew attention to the health issues involved. Moreover, a large part of the urban working class population, notably casual labourers, whose job security was lowest, occupied the same housing for only a few months. And that affected their ability to vote in the 19th century. In response to difficult circumstances, there was much religious activism, as in the early period, with committed clerics and laity seeking to make Christian teaching more accessible. This reflected the degree to which towns were seen as the centres for competition, both with irreligion and also between faiths, notably between Anglicanism and nonconformity, and between Anglicanism and Catholicism. And as a result of that, there was, an attempt to build more churches, and there was also a focus on the part of both the Anglicans and the Catholics on what were called slum priests, who took the church's message to the urban poor. Anglican church interiors were rebuilt in order to replace box pews, which belonged to families, with rows of identical open pews, most of which were rent-free and open to all. Careful appointments of clerics were intended to improve the church. There was less non-residence by clergymen, less pluralism. There was attempts to have particular chaplaincies. So St. Peter's Northampton kept up with urban growth there by introducing a chaplaincy for shoemakers and a railway chaplain. Missions, notably to the East End of London, such as Oxford House, sought to reach out to those who didn't go to church, lecturing, for example, on Sunday afternoons in Victoria Park in Bethnal Green. Working class areas tended not just to be served by these missions, but also in particular to have non-conformist chapels. For example, the Rope Walk district of Ipswich had a Congregationalist one. But I think it's fair to say that attempts to proselytize in working class areas were often of only limited success. That doesn't mean of no success, but often of limited success. And indeed, concern about atheism and irreligion focused on towns, particularly London, and was an aspect of a wider sense of urban malaise. Drink maps were used to fight the cause for temperance in a number of towns, including Leicester, Liverpool, London, Manchester, Norwich, Oxford, and Sheffield. They sought to shock by demonstrating the widespread availability of alcohol and suggesting that tackling this would help tackle crime, poverty, and poor health. And this was particularly endorsed by liberal politicians as opposed to conservatives. There were also more conservatives tended to argue in favour of personal freedom. And you could argue that you see similar debate at the present moment over things like smoking in pub gardens. There was also moral panics about political radicalism, sexual behaviour, moral depravity and much else. Despite the failure of Chartism in 1848, London in particular continued to be a centre of radical thought, not least republicanism. But in practice, the scale of disaffection was modest, certainly prior to the 1880s. But at the same time, again, emphasising the number of factors at play, it was an element in urban life and in the reaction to it. Furthermore, the idea that there was so-called criminal class was a product, and that it was a product of moral degeneracy, was linked to a reading of a particular environment, namely the townscape of the unrespectable working class, i.e. near where you live, because the majority of the population obviously lived in the towns, the concerned were told there were sink beds of moral depravity, and obviously the threat therefore was that it was going to come and get you. I mean, there was that paranoid quality or character to urban life. In response to health issues and based on town councils and existing local boards of health, the 1872 Public Health Act sought to tackle sanitation. In particular, there was an emphasis on clean water. In part, this was an engineering and organisational triumph, but there was also the process by which the countryside was increasingly subordinated to the town. Many towns looked far afield, Manchester to the distant Lake District, to supplement water supplies from the nearby Pennines. So the Corporation of Manchester, which was very wealthy, purchased the Withbourne estate, stopped the local lead industry in order to prevent water pollution, so much for the jobs of locals, and despite overwhelming local opposition, gained parliamentary approval in 1877 for the drowning of the Thirlmere Valley for a reservoir. In other words, Manchester easily and readily, as it were, outweighed Cumbria. Meanwhile, for example, Brighton obtained adequate water in the 1860s and an intercepting sewer in 1874. There was also legislative pressure for improvement to the housing stock, notably with the provision of toilets, or, for example, under the 1894 London Building Act, the provision of window area. You know, each dwelling should have a certain amount of windows. The Public Health Act of 1875 took forward into general legislation many of the provisions of the Town Improvement Clauses Act of 1847, including those relating to the layout and naming of new streets and the effect on utilities. The Adulteration Act of 1878 stipulated the important appointment of local analysts. So that's people to see, for example, if the milk is contaminated. A Royal Commission on the Housing of the Working Class was held in 1884-5 and led to the Housing of the Working Classes Act of 1890, which enabled the president of the local government board to authorise local authority housing schemes. All of this legislation, incidentally, can be read online, and it's quite interesting to do so. It's also interesting to follow up the parliamentary debates about these Acts of Parliament. It's worth bearing in mind that it's also interesting to note that the paths that were not followed. So, for example, compared to, say, Paris, there was not a large amount of fortification to, as it were, deal with the possibility of a future war. In 1860, General Sir John Burgoyne, whose statue is on Cambridge Place in London, had proposed a defensive ring around London of 28 forts and batteries, mounting 1,050 guns and to be manned by a permanent garrison of 17,000 troops. Colonel Sir Shafto Adair followed in 1862 with a proposal for 71 forts and batteries, 2,192 guns and 25,600 troops, but neither proposal was implemented. Instead, the reliance was on the navy, with the major defensive focus for the army on the protection of the major naval dockyards of Plymouth and Portsmouth, while Dover was also seen as an exposed position. And there were, of course, troops in the London area, the Household Division in particular, but not of the numbers that had been projected by the fortification enthusiasts. Within towns, the focus was on the police. Crime fell appreciably in the later decades of the 19th century, and there was scant need of the army to maintain civil order. Although there were tactical and other differences, liberal and conservative governments both supported reform, which focused on towns due to the size of their population, and also what was seen as their particular problems. So, for example, the Recreation Grounds Act of 1859 and the Public Health Act of 1875 encouraged the laying out of public parks, but the key elements were local. Public Health Act, incidentally, of 1875, passed by the Disraeli government. The first Manchester Park opened in 1846. Moore Park in Preston was established as a park in 1867. Halifax opened the People's Park, paid for by Sir Francis Crossley, the MP and owner of the local carpet mills. Liverpool Corporation purchased farmland from the Earl of Sefton, and in 1872, the 265-acre Sefton Park was opened, typically by a member of the royal family, the Duke of Connaught, who seems to have gone round opening just about everything in that period. Wolverhampton gained parks in 1881 and 1895. Municipal parks and buildings testified to the strength of local identity and to the desire and ability to improve the local environment. they were generally kept in better nick than they are today. And so also with clubs and activities. So, for example, in the town of Street in Somerset, more famous as a shoe production town, the brass band was formed by 1870. More generally, there was an entrepreneurial response, with music halls and football clubs founded in large numbers to address the opportunities offered by urban working class leisure within the context of new mass commercialized interests. Cinema, of course, was to join the music hall at the beginning, essentially the end of our beginning of the next one. The boom in sport was considerable. In 1901, 111,000 spectators stood on. I mean, remember, there wasn't the all-seated stadiums which diminished the numbers of 111,000 spectators stood on the banks of Crystal Palace, which was the football stadium that hosted the cup finals from 1895 to 1914, to watch Tottenham beat Sheffield United in the final. Towns were also a centre for middle-class sports. So Northumberland Cricket Club had a ground in Newcastle by the 1850s, while Newcastle Golf Club expanded its activities in the 1890s. Other forms of leisure, restaurants, food outlets multiplied. So the first permanent Lyons tea shop was founded in 1894. As the largest city in the world, London had the largest middle class and therefore a particularly large service sector, from servants to restaurants. On the part of politicians, reform encompassed an attempt to woo as well as to redefine the expanding urban electorate. So, for example, on the 3rd of July 1852, the Leader in the Western Times, that's the first editorial, and the Western Times was a newspaper that supported free trade and was against protectionism, declared, quote, "The Exeter election is fixed for Wednesday and Thursday next. The crisis demands the earnest zeal and unabated exertions of every reformer. The enemy has been tampering with and endeavouring to seduce the poorer voters by the usual profligate expenditure in intoxicating drinks. Many a poor family will lament the broken health of a parent and protector ruined and debauched by the agents of the protectionist faction." They just can't write the things like that these days. The pretended friends of religion and order. "The honest and independent portion of the electors must endeavour by all lawful means to defeat the corruptors by watching over the weak and warning them of the consequences of accepting the Tory bribes, whether in drink or coin." Sounds quite an exciting election, actually. Nobody's ever offered me a drink for a vote. The Municipal Corporations Act of 1835, which I mentioned earlier, was followed by the Second and Third Reform Acts of 1867 and 1884, the 1885 Redistribution of Seat Acts, and Local Government Acts in 1888 and 1894, which created county councils, county borough councils, and borough and district councils. These bodies then launched many local acts of Parliament, taking forward a long-established practice in order to improve their localities, plus and defend their own or advance their own particular interests and conceit, minus. There were also major electoral consequences, which were both general to the country and also specific to particular constituencies. As a result of the 1867 Second Reform Act, about 60% of adult males in boroughs had the vote. There was also a redistribution of seats, as a result of which less populous boroughs, such as Honiton in Devon, lost their seats, while the designation of new parliamentary boroughs, such as Darlington, Hartlepool and Stockton, reflected population growth and could contribute to political transformation. So, for example, in the election of 1868, the son of the Marquess of Londonderry, the Marquess of Londonderry was the local aristocrat, lost at and was a Tory, lost at Stockton to a Liberal. Meanwhile, the 1870 Education Act provided the context of spreading literacy. Alongside the end of newspaper taxes and therefore falling costs, this was a background to the expansion of the press. Whereas in 1868, 14 of the largest English provincial towns, including Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester, Sheffield, Newcastle, Bristol, Plymouth, Nottingham, North Shields, and Bradford had had daily newspapers, by 1885, 47 provincial towns did. They sought to cater for particular local needs and to direct local opinion while making profits and varying content. So, for example, in Leeds, thanks to a newspaper focus on sport and other leisure items, there was success in creating a cross-class conservative coalition, one that bridged the slums and the suburbs. The emphasis on the public that was increasingly common in political discussion from the late 19th century perforce focused, as I've already mentioned, on towns, as this was where the public was most numerous and active. Urban-based, the press also focused on towns. So, for example, the Exeter-based Western Times in its issue of the 30th of August 1901 mentioned, quote, the instincts of a democratic people in a report on the substantial fall of the Conservative majority in a by-election at Andover. In that newspaper's issue of the 29th of January 1901, discussion of a change in political culture focused on the major towns. And it's worth listening. I'll just read you a passage I transcribed from that newspaper. The originals can be found in the Devon and Exeter Institute, so you don't have to read it online. And I want to transcribe it, A, because of what it says, but B, because I think this is interesting in giving you what was regarded as a reasonable tone in newspaper discussion. And if effort is to be made in the forthcoming elections to boards of guardians to elect working men and women guardians favourable to a liberal interpretation of the local government board's order respecting more outdoor relief for the aged poor in preference to so often offering the house, by which it means work, the workhouse. So they're not referring to the House of Commons as a place to put people in who are otherwise unable to look after themselves and are suffering from alcoholism, but maybe they should have done. The movement is, we hear, likely to be taken up in earnest in all the big towns, and there seems to be no reason why it should not become general. Outdoor relief is humane, and it has not been proved to be wasteful. It will be more economical than building and furnishing separate wings for aged couples who are permitted to live together in workhouses. At any rate, the working classes are advised that they can now make an effective start in the direction of the old age pension, so often promised them, by voting only for such guardians as will promise liberal outdoor relief to the undisabled aged poor. Now, the sentence at the beginning and the sentence at the end, you will notice, are both very long, and it was assumed that they should be readily understood. I think you would find that such long sentences, well, I can tell you, such long sentences are far less common in modern newspapers directed at that clientele. The urban working class itself was doing relatively well. There was no equivalent to the agricultural depression in the countryside, which essentially arose from free trade and food imports hitting agriculture, but obviously depressing prices to the great benefit of the urban working class. And that was a background for political disputes over free trade. In other words, not only gaining the vote, affluent workers were also a key support for the continual growth of consumerism. But as I mentioned earlier today, low pay, casual work and underemployment ensured that many in the working class couldn't share in these benefits. Moreover, the growing international competition that hit manufacturing affected many towns, leading to unemployment and encouraging emigration, which, alongside movement within the country, was part of the churn that characterised much of the urban population and that affected urban life. Towns in turn were policed, a process might have made obligatory by the County and Borough Police Act of 1856. This served not only to offer a protection from crime, which was sought by many of the poor, but also for the regimentation of urban society, notably working class immorality, which was much to the fore in towns, as drinking, crime and illegal gambling were important leisure activities. Practices judged unacceptable, such as public drunkenness, were subject to admonition, regulation and action. However, the complaints that focused on the Royal Commission on the Duties of the Metropolitan Police of 1906-8 revealed that low-level corruption, not least demanding money from prostitutes, was an aspect of this policing. A different form of action was provided by religious bodies such as the Salvation Army, which was founded in London in 1865. I think we'll pause at that moment, because what we're trying to do is to show the range and variety. And I want in the next one to sort of focus on the very end of the 19th century. But I wonder, Graham, if there are any particular points you think relevant at the moment.
Well, there certainly are, Jeremy. I mean, so many interesting aspects you bring up there in your talk. I want to just focus for the moment on a little bit more on sanitation. You mentioned the 1875 Public Health Act with its requirement for lavatories with houses, albeit the lavatories generally in the garden or a little block at the back. A couple of thoughts. I mean, are those lavatories plugged into anything, by which I mean a pipe that can take waste away? How do they function? And secondly, what requirements, if any, were there before 1875 that houses should have sanitation of that kind?
Right. Number one, what you have, depending upon where you are in the country and whether there is mains drainage, is you either have mains drainage or you have what we would call cesspits. And I think it's fair to say that mains drainage is more common in urban areas, cesspits are more common in rural areas, where, of course, there is also a value to be gained from using them as manure. I think one of the points to bear in mind about much of this legislation is what you are seeing is the national standardisation and, as it were, introduction as compulsory of a regulatory environment that prior to that had often been more episodic and more voluntary. And that is a major change in the nature of regulation. But at the same time, it works more in some directions than others. So if you think about it, until the National Health Service, there was much more variety, often very successfully so, in hospital provision than was to be the case thereafter when there was an attempt to produce standardisation. In the late 19th century in education, you get attempt to standardise the ages at which children go to school and to make that compulsory, as well as a number of other provisions of education. And you get what are known as board schools, by which you mean Board of Education schools being constructed. That doesn't mean there wasn't the public provision of education in urban areas prior to that, but it does mean that it's become standardised and regulatory. And I think it's fair to say that this was seen with both the conservatives and the liberals. There were different tendencies. The liberals were more regulatory, but the conservatives also believed in standards. And you get the phrase, I think it's Sir William Harcourt's phrase, who was a significant politician, I think when he said, we're all socialists now, a bit later, by which he meant gas and water socialists. In other words, people that believe there should be public provision of national utilities and that these should be regulated. The point being, of course, that as I discussed in my History of London, the eventual cost of these programs produces significant ratepayer disquiet from the, well, certainly by the 1890s, in some cases prior to that. And as a result of that, that affects the character of urban politics because, and this will not surprise us from today, the ambition of people to regulate, you might think, for example, the what has been announced by the Energy Secretary, Mr. Miliband, today at the Labour Party conference, the ambition to regulate surpasses affordability. And now you could argue that affordability is a construction. You could argue that people should have been taxed more heavily for public sanitation earlier in the century, earlier in that is in the late 19th century. Or you could point out that the practicality of crowding out the private sector by taking more and more resources out of it to support the public sector was economically inefficient and dangerous. So you can take different points of view. There is, in the end of the day, a political character to this, and I would be misleading you if I didn't make it clear that there is also, therefore, potentially a political character to the analysis. And I would urge listeners to form their own views. What I would like them to be is informed. And I've already mentioned today, you can find a lot of the parliamentary debates online. And on top of that, you can find a lot of local newspapers either online and or available in local libraries. And those are, again, worth reading. I mean, they are tricky. I mean, in the local newspapers are not indexed. The type is, as you might know, rather small. It's only some of the major national ones that have been indexed, but it's the local ones that often give you the flavour of urban politics and also enable you to see the tensions that surround what can otherwise be a bland account, or I hope I'm not being bland, but what might seem a bland account of new legislation and its implementation.
Well, that's an interesting point to end on. Professor Jeremy Back, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.